Okay, it is January 11th of 2014. I'm sitting here with Jim Anderson. We're continuing our Jim's talking of his aviation career. Today we have no photos to jog your memory. We've been through all the photos that I managed to get scanned. So today is going to be all off the top of your head, on, especially about infield recoveries and your career in general. Anything you want to talk about?
Well, yeah. It's hard to do without getting reminded, because I looked through the disc you gave me of the ones you had scanned, and I had forgotten about a lot of those airplanes. Mm-hmm. Some I'm looking at them, I'm wondering where was that at, and who was I working for? Mm-hmm. It goes on and on. Some of them stick out in your head. The Otter blew a piston over on a river somewhere out, I think in Norvik. And it's spring, and we got to get right over there. And Buck was trying to get the piston off, and I'm down there tearing things apart, and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I was very happy. I found all the valve parts that had broken and messed it up." Mm-hmm. And then I'm taking off some intake pipes, and the blower section is full of little bitty parts and pieces. And I said, "Well," you could see he was getting a little irritated because I wasn't up there trying to help him. I said, "Look at this." He looks in there and he says, "Oh my." He says, "You know, I once changed a cylinder on a Beaver because a valve let go." And he says, "I changed cylinders all summer long all over the country." He says, "I never thought to look in here." But it all worked out well. Flew it back at Cotsview.
Buck Maxim?
Yeah. I did an awful lot of work for him. He told me once, he says, if it hadn't been for me, he probably wouldn't have made it. Guess every time he called, I'd pack up and go over and work on his planes. He didn't have any mechanics around Cotsview that were available. They were all working for somebody else. Mm-hmm. Then he says, "You ought to kind of come up here and work the summer, maybe." Or I mentioned it. He says, "No, I wouldn't work. Because all these guys, they're not going to hire my mechanic, or the guy that works on my airplanes. He might tear their plane down and say it's broke. That's it." You know, a lot of jealousy. It's the strangest thing. Buck went over there with a 185 on floats. He was about the only large float plane there. Well, he did real good for their first season. And God, everybody's looking at this. And the second season went good. Then two or three guys got floats in 185s. And then there wasn't enough money for anybody.
What was, when Buck was at his height, how many planes was he operating?
Oh, my. He had two Westwind Beaches, which is a Beach D-18 with turbines on it, PT-6s, but it's still a tail dragger. Beautiful airplanes. They were really, whoever designed up the installations and all, it was very good looking. And so he had two of those. At one time there were two Otters, one Beaver, and of course he always had a Maul sitting by for... He'd usually hire some younger pilot to fly that, and the short trips, runway trips, things like that. And then, of course, he used it in the fall for hunters. Mm.
Did he ever delve into tourism much?
No.
Flight scene?
Well, in a way he did. He used to take rafters and canoers and kayakers way up the headwaters of Noatak and drop them off. Mm. So there's a lake way up there they could land in, because the Noatak's pretty shallow in that area. And he said one time he got in there and he had a couple passengers and their stuff. He said, "Boy, we're indignant." He said, "There must have been 20 people there. A couple other outfits had showed up about the same time. Some were going out and some were doing something else. But these people were quite indignant. They wanted a wilderness experience in their middle of a village, you might say." But it all, he said, within 3 hours, there was nobody there.
Did you, you've mentioned there, I can't remember the plane, it was the twin-tailed plane you were putting, that, I think it was out in the Aleutians, maybe?
Oh, at Nelson Lagoon, that's a C-82.
And who, that was?
Belonged to Northern Air Cargo.
Northern Air Cargo.
Yeah.
Did you have people besides Buck and Northern Air Cargo who regularly... Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Northern Air Cargo, Buck, and the rest were just pretty much locals. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And occasionally these guys were oh, I guess you'd call them gypos. They'd run up, show up and run around for a while. They'd usually get a hold of me for different things, mm-hmm. round engines. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were interesting at times. Some people showed up once to get a CE2 that had been parked for a long time. And this other fella, I think it was Dale Briggs. We were down there, geez, it was cold and it was dark, and we'd been heating this engine, and this pilot shows up. He's a muttering and a mumbling, and every time we tried to start, why, the cylinder was hydraulic lock. And this pilot says, "You're not going to get this thing going." I said, "Oh, yeah, we will. In fact, I bet you $10 on it." "Okay, you're on. You know, here it is. It's real miserable, and it's dark." And I told Dale, "You go down there and yank about four or five of the bottom spark plugs out, and we'll start it." And we did. And it blew oil all over the countryside, of course. But it ran. And the guy says, "I don't believe this. Nobody does this shit." I got the airplane all ready to go. It was just as cold as could be. I got it in Ween's hangar to de-ice and do this and that, and check a few more things. I wasn't there. They took it out, and it must have been 30 below. And it took a long time to fuel it. And they didn't start up and run an engine or anything. So they went to start number two, and it was so cold by that time that it snapped up the timing gears. So, of course, that was a lost cause. And I towed it off and parked it. The owners are in Florida, Carolina Aircraft Company. As well, she's done for a while. I said, "I could work on it, but you're going to have to pay for a heater and gas and every other damn thing, and it's miserable and it's slow going." And then they called 3-4 times during the winter, and it was one of those winters where it just kind of hung about 30 below most of the time. They really didn't get to working on it until springtime. Finally got it out.
That was in Fairbanks?
Yeah. Had to go to Anchorage. Luckily, Northern Air Cargo had one engine, an old beater, that was of that series, because, of course, it had to be a little bit different. And I went down and took the parts out of it and went about my business.
Was it any problem using Ween's hangar? Were they okay?
Oh, they ran it out of the space for a couple of days was all, yeah. Yeah, it was just lucked out. They had room. And it was hard to get those in because of the high tails and twins. So you had to bring the plane in kind of, then cock it real tight, swing both the tails through, and then hand turn the nose gear because it's right up against the wall, and then hand push it back a little ways, and you could get it in. Mm-hmm. It was difficult, but it worked. Oh, yes, Ween and their tail door. They're the regular doors. Up above them was about a 20-foot-wide overhead door type thing. So they could, originally it was for to get the tail of the F-27 in. Well, occasionally things would jam up. There was ropes and things and a cat head on a winch over on the wall. And things would go wrong. And I remember one night I was swing shift and we were working away and just taking the plane out. Got another one in and the tail door messed up. Cold, cold weather, as usual. And I happily remember leaving, and it must have been 30 below in the hangar. And the swing shifter said, "It's all yours, fellas," as the graveyard was looking at it going, "Oh, no." cold weather, it's tough on everything. It's like the heavy equipment guys, even the great big scrapers, they shut down at 30 below because the big foot-square steel pieces that hold everything together would break, crack.
More expensive to run them.
Oh, too, yeah. You just didn't know what was going to happen. Things, so many things broke.
Do you have, when you look back on your career, which spans a considerable number of decades, was there a period that you think of as really good years and periods that you think of as really bad in terms of the working?
Yeah, it was always pretty steady. One, it got real bad early pipeline days. Everybody was out of town. Nobody was flying or doing anything. everything was on hold. I'm looking at my little shop, and I've got nothing in there and nothing coming in. And of course, no place does do the annuals outdoors in the summer, so that didn't going to work. And then, in fact, I was over having a beer and mumbling to myself about it. And this fella speaks up, and he says, those aircraft heaters, So I ended up heating trucks and equipment. This fellow was a dispatcher for Sourdough Freight Lines. So I spent the winter, in fact, damn near two of them, heating equipment so they could get up on the haul road. I got it down where it took me about 3 hours to start a Kenworth that was frozen solid. And it just went on like that. It scraped by. It's about like you made enough to keep going. And everybody thought I had it made. I'd be sitting in the pickup with his heaters running. He usually carried two on the back, and sometimes two more on a trailer. Generally, two are about right for trucks. And you got it made. You're sitting in that thing, the pickup, reading a book, getting paid. But they never saw me working half of the night, keeping heaters fixed up to keep running. Oh, yes, it was something else. I don't know how many hours that poor old truck got idling. It was pretty weak by spring, remember? But it got me through the winter. That all worked out fine. And then, Alaska Unlimited called up. It was in the spring. Some holiday, and they had a big job going out at the Moose Creek Agricultural Area. And he says, Jesus, we need you bad. We shut down. You know, the weather had been nice, springtime. For this holiday, let everybody get some time off. It went to 30 below. So they called up and says, come on out and heat this stuff. I'm happily. Okay, you know, it's in the evening. And they got to get going in the morning. I says, okay, I'll get out there and get something going for you. And I thought I was just going to be out there 5 or 6 hours. 24 hours later, without other than dozing in the pickup once in a while, I got back home. They had everything frozen up. Cats and scrapers. And, yeah, just everything you can think of. Oh, yes. One of my better paying days, you might say. And I look back on it. I think sometimes I worked awful cheap.
Did you have to do a... Or maybe not have to. Did you refresh your education on... Or did you go to schools for newer stuff as it came along?
No, because I pretty much kept working on the older airplanes. Mm-hmm. And you get something newer in. Actually, you're not supposed to work on something you don't know anything about. You're supposed to work with somebody that does know it. So it was handicapped a bit that way. But the Beaches, that was... I'd gone to the Pratt & Whitney school with Weems. And I had a general idea of what was going on there and what to check for. But that was mostly... Didn't work on those too much, come to think of it. That's the turbine beaches. The round engine ones, yes. But the turbine ones love cold weather, so there wasn't much problem there. You'd have to do did a hot section or two, and that was about it. This one fellow says, kind of neat, he says. $100,000 worth of engine hanging on a rusty piece of $10 cable.
Other than the scarcity of work during the pipeline years, was there a boom after the pipeline when everybody was moneyed up and buying planes?
Oh, yeah, things went along pretty good then. It got back up to normal. It just stayed busy. Any huge rush other than a spring, maybe with floats, everybody crying to be the first one in the water. Mm-hmm. And then they had to be the last one out. Occasionally you had to go over to thaw some out to get them out of the ice. Mm-hmm. And that's a time-consuming job, everything. Put heat down inside the floats, and fool around and peck around and try to don't hit the float with the axe.
How many... That one year I saw the footage on the KTVF news about the guy who came landing in here at Chena Marina on floats with his wheels down.
Yeah.
How many planes have you seen flip over?
Oh, Well, there was that one. Of course, I saw it afterwards. There's been a couple through the years, and most of the retractable float-type things where they could put wheels up and down in the floats. The first set we ever saw, I was still working at Phillips Field. And the engine shop, which I was working at the time, a lot of windows facing towards the south end of the runway. And we're working away, and all of a sudden there's this horrible beller of an engine going to full throttle immediately. Of course, we all, what the hell's going on, looking out the window? Well, here went this 180 by, amphibious floats, and the wheels are still up, and he's just barely holding it, but he'd done something wrong right at the last minute, and he made it. Mm. But, oh my, the dust was coming off the floats, coming up off the runway behind him. Mm. Oh yeah, it was close. But to keep saying it, it's going to happen to you sooner or later if you got something retractable.
Mm-hmm. When you were down there at Phillips Field, were you working for Jess Bachner?
Well, originally it was Fairbanks Aircraft Service, mm-hmm. and there was three guys were owners. It was Jess, Gordy Mitchell, and Dave Phillips. And then Dave sold out, and then later on Gordy sold out, so Jess ended up with it. Mm-hmm. I forget what, I went off the Army, I went and did something. And when I come back, it was Bachner's. Mm. Yeah. First one over to Phillips, there couldn't have been more than a dozen airplanes parked around there. Mm. And it, through the years, filled up. Of course, this opened up. Phillips was gone. And I moved over here in 94. There weren't very many airplanes and hardly any float planes even. Mm. And now people are looking for parking space. Even though there's not much flying now, if you've got a plane, you can't hardly sell it. Changing times.
Just the economics of...
Yeah, well, you know, $6 a gallon for gas, it costs $12,000, $13,000 to get a private license. And people used to buy a Super Cub or an old plane to go out hunting, fishing. Well, now they get a four-wheeler, and they don't have to fool with licenses. And the FAA and annual inspections, and they can drink beer and drive around, enjoy themselves. I expect in the future it might go back, but actually the FAA has made it more difficult all the time to get a license. The old theory was, and you could use the solo in about 8 to 12 hours, some people even less, but... Then you do your practicing and figure out your cross country, how to navigate a little bit, which up here generally meant following the river or the railroad. Mm-hmm. And then you turn you loose. You'd have maybe 40 hours in, you get your private license. Well, now it takes more time, and there's night time, and there's this time, and there's that time, and there's more rules, regulations. It just discourages people. Mm-hmm. The cry is now, where are we going to find more pilots? We're running out of pilots. You're doing the same thing they always did. They're getting ex-military. Mm-hmm. A lot of them.
Are your clientele, are they tend to be getting older and older? People?
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a couple of younger ones around. It's the same thing. Well, here again, it's human nature, I think. They get interested in the plane, they learn to fly, they use it and carry on for 4 or 5 years, and then the interest wanes and they're off to something else, a boat at Valdez or some other thing. Bow hunting on foot, who knows, it all changes. Wives and kids have a lot to do with not flying too. Two expenses like that is too much. I did that myself once. I got hold of some old Stinson gull wings, and I was going to rebuild one because I thought that was just the prettiest airplane in the world. And I actually built a shop that had the right door and the right spacing to get this fuselage in because they were big. And I got everything done and got a little slack time in the winter. I said, I'll just do this, get started here and see what I got to do. Push that fuselage in and look at it. And thinking about the wife and three little kids, I says, this is not going to work. So I had to sell them. That was the end of my gullwing career right there.
Are there, through the years of working on all sorts of different planes, when I work on a car sometimes, it almost seems like the engineers have in mind to make life as difficult as possible for you, almost so that you mm-hmm. can't work on something. Have there been some planes that are just a joy to work on and others that are more difficult? And
oh, yeah, yeah. The actually, the D-18 Beach was a little difficult to work on because it wasn't quite high enough to stand on it. It was too high to squat on it if you're working on anything in the landing gear wells or anything like that. And I think it was pretty tight around the engine area. But that was built back when, you know, they didn't think about labor costs much. Built back in the 30s. Some of the later ones made you wonder about them. But there's usually one or two things on each one that's a little bit, why do I have to do this time? Yeah. Where they put the batteries a lot of times, they're way in behind everything, hard to get to. And the instrument panels are usually a bear because it's pretty good when it first comes out, but then people add things and radios appear and disappear, and that just makes it harder and harder to get to anything. But that's just a fact of life. Modifications do screw things up here and there. One of the easiest and nicest airplanes to work on was a DC-3. Everything was straightforward, pretty simple. Space to work on things. It was good.
When I started interviewing you here a couple years ago, you said that most of your engines were sent to Anchorage to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
Was there a point in time where the shops would rebuild the engines in-house?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, Fairbanks Aircraft rebuilt engines. Bachner's rebuilt. They had an old-timer named Eldred Qualm, so just a wizard with engines. And his reputation was absolutely perfect. It's the guy who said you'd get a brand-new engine that Qualm built and you'd head right across the ocean and head where you're going. No problem. But then he left and things went downhill there. And the smaller shops were a thing of the past. Northern Consolidated for years had an engine shop. They rebuilt their big engines, round ones, small ones, everything. Of course, you got to remember back prior to World War II, most of them were big, 300 horse at least. They were radials, most of them. Just smaller planes were just too small.
Did Wings, when you were working there, rebuild their own engines?
They were still doing. When I first started, they still had a bunch of 180s and 185s, and they were still doing those. And then the old engine man retired. That was the end of that, too. So from then on, they got sent somewhere else. There was an outfit in Anchorage, Sierra Motive, used to do them. And they sold out. Now it's Alaskan Aircraft Engines. There's two or three overhaul outfits in Anchorage, but not here. It's a lot of money to fix up an engine shop and have her done right.
All tooled up and have the people on hand who know how to use it.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably one of the biggest problems.
When you were here in Chena Marina, where would you send your engines to?
Generally Sierra Motive, and then it was Alaskan Aircraft Engines. Mm. Some of them sent them outside somewhere. They were trading them in, as well as you'd crate them up, send them off, and then send back another engine. That could go anywhere.
What is a person looking at, say, for a 185 to get an engine rebuilt?
Right now? Every about. It depends on it a lot. On how old the engine is and how many things have to be changed mandatorily. For AD notes, other things. But I'd estimate $25,000 probably at a minimum.
So about like buying a new car.
Oh, yeah.
Put
yeah.
an engine in a plane.
Yeah, well, people screaming about the prices on these aircrafts are damn high and they're carrying on. So, did you ever think you'd pay $30,000 for that pickup you got out there? Oh, that's different. They don't think of it. It's on time payment. They'll drive it, drive it, drive it. No, it's everything's relative.
What's a guy looking to insure a plane nowadays?
I have no idea. Not at all.
I would have asked my dad about that, but I don't know that he ever carried insurance.
No, most people didn't. Commercial operators, a lot of them have, well, it depends on how much money, if they owe on the airplane. Then they have to have hull insurance. Everybody has to have liability, of course, which is higher than a kite in Alaska. So I was told once that ticket to Fort Yukon, half the price was insurance. And that's been quite a few years ago. Some insurance companies, they'd sell you a good deal on insurance. Then you'd find out it wasn't any good on off-field landings or north of the Arctic Circle. They'd have this in the fine print. What? Here you're paying this money out, you know.
What was the restriction on north of the Arctic Circle?
I don't know. They just put that in there because once it got up there and crashed, it was done for. There was no way to get it back out. Yeah, it's just interesting.
Did you and Terry talk about anything at the, when he was questioning you at the Pioneer Air Museum? Anything that you can think of that infield recoveries or?
No, not right off. Mm. No. It was just some of the other stuff that just reminded me of. I think we probably talked about them already.
I would sorely have liked to have gotten that other half of those photo albums scanned.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah. Yeah, things were swinging along pretty good. And everything was paid for. I could have kicked back and been more selective in customers or built our own airplane or whatever. Losing that hangar really wiped things down.
Stone's still bugging you?
That's sore. So. Seems like it wiggled around a bit before it took off.
Do you know, I'm trying to think of Arvid's last name, but with a name like Arvid.
Arvid Weplin?
Yeah, the guy who, he ran the
A&P school for
A&P
a long
school
time.
For a while.
Yeah.
I went down and talked to him one day, and just to get some more background on mechanics and A&P school and he mentioned a string of instructors down there who had plane crashes and passed away. I think he said there was three of them in a row before he got there, I think it was. Do you happen to remember any of those people? I think it was around the 80s that happened.
There was one, Reggie Bickford. He taught for, I think only 1 year. And he was over at Nome. He was coming to Fairbanks with a Bonanza to get an annual of things. It crashed. Something of what went wrong there. Can't think of any others had crashes.
Were there, you taught there for a while. Do you know anything about any of the instructors who were there before you taught there?
Not really. One guy, Ed Phelps, in fact, that's how I went to work there. Ed was working part-time. He was an ex-Ween mechanic. And he calls up and he says, I'd like to go fishing and can get this squared away. Would you fill in for me for a month? I said, well, that sounded pretty good. So I went over and started carrying on. Ed gets back and he says, you know, the fish are running the Chitna. And you got a wife and a kid. Why don't you keep this job? I said, well, I'll go talk to him. They said, yeah. So Ed left. I first went to work there. I took that job. It's just me teaching as a joke. Actually, it turned out I enjoyed it. But you can't teach 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and 12 months a year. You've got to have some break time in there. Or at least I did. After about 4 years, I was just burnt out. somebody would say, "Hey, Jim," and I'd lose my cool, because that's all I heard all day long. We tried at that time, we tried to kind of run it like it was a shop. And it worked out pretty well, I think. There was Bob Richards and I was the only two there for a long time. He stayed with them after I left. By that time, Anderson Aircraft had started building up enough where I could figure I could cut loose. Mm-hmm. Probably one of my great mistakes. I stayed on and had all of the state health and welfare and pensions and everything.
Have you been down to the new AMP program there on the East Ramp?
I haven't been in there yet at all. Mm-hmm. I was invited over, and I had something going on. I couldn't get away. I had promised somebody something.
I think it was FedEx who donated them.
A jet. Yeah. That was good, and they got some nice big helicopters there. It looks pretty good, and that's what they needed was space, and near a runway is best. Mm-hmm. So there's a little activity that you can see and hear and watch a little bit, occasionally anyhow. But Metro was perfect because we shared the hangar, or the hangar shop, everything, with Air North, who had small airplanes. Mm-hmm. And we'd use the kids to open up plates. Everybody got to play around a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You enjoyed the teaching?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
It seems like you catch a little energy off the young, enthusiastic students.
Oh, gosh. And you try to tamper them down a bit. Some of the things that happen to make you wonder. See somebody standing there talking while using the drill press. You know, funny thing. He's been drilling a long time and go over there. What's going on here? Oh, I'm just doing this. We better look at this. The drill's halfway through the bottom plate on the press and everything, and he's just been leaning on the handle talking. Some of those guys really, really sharp, and others, why, they usually dropped out after a bit. Yeah.
Before Terry, who do you have working for you in the shop here at Junior Marine?
Oh, couple of different guys at different times, but basically alone. Mm. One fella, Peter Welch. Peter was pretty good, and he got on dope, so that didn't work. Mm. Poor Bassett, young guy too, and he was driving outside, and stopped at the border, so he wasn't feeling too good. He just maybe stay there the night. Bad headache. He walked in the office in the morning, have some coffee, and what they call it, aneurysm, something let go in his head, and he died right there. Hmm. A young guy, too. Shame. But he got in a dope of some sort, and you guess all of a sudden you realize there's something wrong. And one day everything's fine, the next day they're arguing with you about some little thing. Hmm. No, this is the way you got to do it. And you tell them, no, it ain't. And I know. Hmm. But they go ahead and do it anyhow. That's bum. That stuff is bad. God knows I fought with alcohol a couple of years, but phew, that dope, that's something else again.
How many years did you have Terry working for you?
Jesus. I don't know exactly when he showed up. Huh. 4 or 5, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
He took a little break in his AMP career and worked on heavy equipment for a while.
Oh, yeah, for a long time. Yeah, he got out of AMP school, and he was working in airplanes. And, you know, it wasn't much money at the time, this and that. His father-in-law convinced him that, why don't you go heavy equipment here or something? Because people who were working for it, there was not much of anything except wages, and if you did something wrong, you were gone. They didn't protect you from the FAA or help you or do anything. Well, they, bunch of high binders. And Terry was pretty disgusted, so he went 302. Did well there, finally retired. Had enough, been in it for years. As he said when he showed up, he says, I kind of like to work in airplanes now. I got a retirement I can afford to. We did pretty well through those years. It's a two-man operation is better than one, because if you got to go get parts or do anything else, you got to close down. And invariably, that's when people show up, and then they say, oh, we never can catch you. It's one of those things.
It's kind of tough for a... I mean, the A&P mechanics don't really make a lot right out the gates, do they?
No. No, and I don't know what it is now. Back at Ween's, let's see, that was what, 1966, 67? I was getting $5.10 an hour, and that ain't much in Fairbanks, even though it was, you know, it was a 40-hour week, and yak, 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 and you got this and that. And I found out, prior to that, my God, it was three-something odd an hour. They talked about their retirement plan or pension plan. A couple of the old timers retired. Next thing you know, they're bitching. They're only getting about $65, $70 a month, which was all right in 1929, but it didn't work too well in the 60s. Oh, yeah.
You know,
most of the smaller outfits, small shops, they can't afford all this health and welfare and crap. It just is too much overhead then. Lord knows you got enough just with the taxes and heat and lights, insurance, everything.
You've mentioned before that Ween was kind of a pilot-oriented operation.
That was my impression, yeah.
Was it very out front? Were the mechanics obviously treated with less respect? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like... we decided the Mechanics Association that we had theirs, which was worked pretty well. Ween's didn't want to listen to them. They were going to go to a 40-hour week. Well, we couldn't survive on 40 hours. There's no way. And we're trying to get a raise, and finally got down. We're going to have to go union or something. And one of the pilots stops, and he's talking away, and he said, well, you guys can't go on strike. He says, you know, this and that, and I won't fly. And you just got to have a lower standard of living. Wait a minute. If anything... made a guy get pissed, that would be it right there. So if the pilot could have a better car, we'd take less money. No. Most of the overhead had been ex-pilots. So just goes along with the territory. And then Ween's got tangled up with its overhead and its leasing program. Oh, it just... There's people in the company that bought airplanes and rented them to the company. And it was... That's kind of political. Of course, any place you've got more than two people working, you're going to have politics. Of some sort.
Has Georgie been by at all lately?
No, I haven't seen him, Al, for a long time.
The fellow who used to run around and come visit with Al Wright passed away, right?
Yeah, Ted Ruffley, yeah.
Have you heard anything from Al?
No, not for quite a while. He dropped by one day and chewed the fat a bit. Away he went. Here's an interesting fella. Oh, I don't know how many times he went broke and started over again. He never quit.
Do you know if Georgie's health's doing all right?
I haven't seen him at all. No.
Do you have pilots from your years of working that stood out in your mind as really good pilots or really good guys?
They kind of sort themselves out. And then there's been a few that's carrying on, and you just know they're not going to last. They were just... thought they knew too much. Others, some of them were very easy on the airplanes. Some of them are continually bending something. And this old-timer's advice was right. When the pilot screws up, the truth ain't in him. You know, it just... Nobody likes to move with doing something wrong. It's just human nature. You kind of sort it out, figure out, well, I got to watch out. Do this or do that.
Have you ever had pilots come back and accuse you of doing something wrong on their airplane and that was the reason for an incident or anything like that? Because like you said, the truth's not in them.
No, it wouldn't be blaming me so much as usually something else. You know, The sand was too deep. The wind was wrong. The wind dropped. That's the usual one. And there was a sinker at the end of the runway. That's a good one. Goes on that way. Mm. There's another variable in there. Of course, as the guy showed up, said his engine was running rough. I think he was the last one to work on it. I didn't remember this thing. I had worked on it all right about 3 or 4 years previously. And I don't think a spark plug had been out of it since. Mm. Yeah, I got an engine man in Anchorage. I asked him once. He says, I said, how often do you get these guys walking in telling you your engine quit? Oh, boys. One of them, I overhauled that engine almost 20 years before. It had been worn out for years, and this guy gets it and he walks in and says, your engine's no good. Oh, that's, yeah, that goes on.
Well, I don't have much else to ask you about, Jim, for now. I suppose when I'm slowly but surely getting the interviews, it takes me about 20 hours to take an interview that we've done and put it on, type it out.
Oh.
And as I go through those, other questions and stuff will come to mind. I don't have anything really fresh to ask you.
Oh, okay.
At this point, if you think of other, especially infield recoveries or other things that you'd like to be included, maybe jot them down. And
yeah, well, if I looked at the thing, I could come up with something. I'm sure the disc. But nothing really strikes real serious. Mm.
The kind of the plan is I got one more class to take this spring, and then I think in the fall semester it'll be project time where I spend 6 credits of time doing the project. This web page I'm trying to do with your voice and the pictures everything. Oh. So it'll be working through the summer and next spring. Hopefully I'll have a product out that you can listen to and look at, and everybody can look at and listen to. That'll be my graduate project. Trying to work on the project and working full time and taking 9 credits. And then throw two or three surgeries into the mix.
Yeah,
it's been crazy as can be, and I'm still monkeying around with my construction stuff. But hopefully, if you can just bear with me through the summer, and by this time next year, I believe that there'll be a product.
Remember, I'm way up in my 70s. You better not hesitate too long.
Yeah.
I better go take a pee. He says, your stove. Something wrong here. You can see the exhaust is all black and sooty. Mm-hmm. I says, oh, shit. He pushes a couple buttons around. He says, there, now it'll start cleaning. I never set up the self-clean on it.
Ah.
So then I got in there, air hose, and blew around inside of it. It's been fine, except it burns oil. Mm. Geez, you see that thing in the news, the meeting they had with the EPA or DEC or whoever it is about the wood stoves. And that poor old guy out there at North Pole, I felt sorry. I felt right in the same bucket. He says, I'm on Social Security. And I'm going to burn wood because if I burn fuel oil, I can't eat.
Mm.
So he undoubtedly, he's got a place he can cut some wood or do something. But Jesus Christ. I'm paying more for fuel oil than I are for gas. Something is definitely wrong.
Do you know if, when they're talking about the liquefaction plant up on the North Slope for natural gas, when they finally get everything in place, will they be able to truck that out to residences, or is it all going to be piped?
Well, the logical thing is to put the plant up there, run a line through here and on down. So, you know, other people can use it or whatever. Anchorage, God knows, they've got enough. They've found more oil, more gas, more everything. But, if they get it here, of course, they have to store it here, and then they feed her into the lines for the customers. And one outfit here has got underground lines and everything feeding to a bunch of people. Mm. And, of course, they've been trucking in from Anchorage or down south someplace.
But can you have a tank? Like, because I'm thinking they don't even have GCI cable where I live. It'll be 50, 100 years before they get a pipe.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Well, probably because we had a... They're living out there on the Sheep Creek Road. Why? We had a great big 300-gallon tank, it was. 300 pounds, a good-sized tank. Mm. For propane for the stove. And it just lasted forever. Mm. I'm sure you can have a storage yard tank, too. Mm. Of course, they had to be kept in pretty good shape, too. Mm.
Yeah, I have to sit down and figure out the economics of getting a new furnace and new tank.
Oh, yeah, it all comes in. They act like it's the cure to everything, but it's not. Mm. There's a lot of infrastructure got to go in before you can really get that squared away.
Yeah, the whole wood stove thing, it's kind of a tough debate. I mean, I know some people who've got... The one guy I know has got a son who's had congestive heart failure at birth, and when the air gets bad, his son has trouble breathing. But just the plain reality of it is a lot of people can't afford fuel. So do you...
If we relied just on fuel oil, we'd be in a son of a bitch shape. Wood ain't cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But you do get a real good backup, for one thing. And... It's cheaper than oil. Mm. You get more BTU out of for your money if you got a good stove. What the hell is it, about 300 a cord now or something?
Cut.
But there's a lot of BTUs there. Mm. And it's a nice dry heat. It feels good and everything else.
Nothing quite like...
I remember back in the 40s, fucking ice fog was really thick, and there wasn't that many cars or anything around. And it was all wood and coal smoke. And a lot of people are starting to burn coal again. They all say the same thing. It's dirty, but it's cheap.
Mm.
You can afford it.
Our neighbor started burning coal right by where we live, and you can smell it. And it's not the most pleasant smell, but I couldn't have the heart. He's such a nice guy. I would never... Tell him that his stove smells bad. I can live with a little stink in the air.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure they could make those more efficient, too.
Mm. I've got a friend. He basically runs the old MUS power plant. He's the lead mechanic or foreman or whatever you call him. And he's got a coal-burning operation. And I had to finally ask him one day what his little shed was. And he's like, well, that's where my boiler is. And he burns coal, and it doesn't have that odor. He's just... been working so many years at burning coal, he's figured out a good way to do it.
You got the damn... Always forget... You know what it's like to burning coal, but it's... At these plants down there healing and everything, but it's all ground up and practically injected.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty clean plants.
Mm-hmm.
When you go back in time a bit, they're carried on about Alaska and this and that. Stuart Udall was the guy. Oh, Jesus. Closing up this, closing up that. And at the same time, Arizona, they're building coal-fired plants that are polluting the Grand Canyon.
Mm. Oh. It seems like a lot of those coal-fired plants out there in Arizona were on Indian reservations, too. I remember driving through there. Every time you see a new reservation, there's a new coal plant and they're piping electricity to Phoenix.
Oh, yeah, everywhere, yeah. Yeah, but they made a deal. They got... cheaper, lower rates and all kinds of shit. And, of course, the government was mixed up in it. And where'd all the BIA money go and a few other odds and ends?
Stuart Udall, public enemy number one. Or was it Morris Udall? There was two of them.
Stuart,
okay.
Yeah.
He was the Jimmy Carter's Secretary of Interior,
oh, Jesus,
right?
Yeah. Oh, God. Alaska's got, my God, tons. There's a coal streak that runs from up on the Arctic coast all the way down to Homer. And it goes through, of course, Yosa Valley, Healy. Starts off at Mead River up in the Arctic. I think they got a different name for it now. But there's a big coal mine up there. Mm-hmm. And they used to bring it in a barrow and burn it. and it goes all the way down. It goes through Big Delta, Black Rapids, sticks out of the cliffs at Homer. I guess it's all one great big vein, the whole thing, just a big, big layer of it.
Is the vein bigger and fatter in Healy?
I don't know.
I guess Healy's also right along the railroad tracks, so that made it a profitable venture.
Well, the Fairbank, not Fairbank, the FE company, United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining. Mm-hmm. You got all this ground up here, and all the dredges were electric. Mm-hmm. And they had a state-of-the-art, and they had to have coal. The railroad got built right through Healy, which was probably one way to go anyhow. That's where the pass is. And there used to be 3 or 4 coal mines down there. Of course, now it's just all use of belly.
How's Judy's winter been going?
Oh, her back's bothering her and everything. She's going to go out and get checked over sometime here in a month or so.
To a back specialist clinic? Or?
Yeah, she Fairbanks doctors don't impress her too much either. So.
So how many years, you started about 52?
Spring of 1954 when I got out of high school, washing parks.
So that would put you at, in 2014, a 60-year career?
Yeah.
Other than your knees, have you had any major injuries along
the way? No, never broke any bones or anything else.
You got all your fingers.
Frostbite. Sore muscles, sprained muscles, torn up ribs. No.
What would you tell a young guy who was interested in becoming an AMP mechanic?
Find something else. The responsibilities are high and the pay is low when you get right down to it. And it's getting more specialized all the time. If you're interested, it's good. I was lucky with something I enjoyed whole life. That's a lot of the real nice people you meet here. Sharp. It's better working on an assembly line in Detroit, that's for sure.
Would you tell a young guy who wanted to be a heavy equipment mechanic anything different?
I think no, it's hard work. But they've got a very good union, and they've got a very good pension plan. And they treat it right. They don't screw it up like the state did. A bunch of other things. The state got way behind their funding on for their pensions and shit because they didn't put anything into it. Which was absolutely, who the hell dreamed that up, you know?
Didn't Parnell just say something about he wanted to fund part of the deficit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it was just a part of it.
Yeah, it's a big lump. Oh, yeah.
That's the same mess that Detroit and all sorts of places have gotten themselves into.
Well, look at the state itself. I don't know what their plan is now, but it used to be if you worked 20 years, you could retire and get your full biddies. Go off. You know, if you started in when you were 20, here you are, you're 40, maybe 45. Of course, it's a good job. You want to stay with it, you know. But a lot of them says, well, we'll go try something else for a while. They go into independent trucking or whatever they good at.
Not too many people can say they've had a 60-year career in anything anymore.
It's probably about right, yeah.
Very few people.
Yeah.
Do you have a...
I have become that oddity, the oldest mechanic around. And I got real lucky, you know, when you think about it. When I first started, there were a lot of the old-timers around yet. Learned an awful lot from them, just listening to their stories, working with them.
Do you have any of those mechanics that stick out more than others as a mentor to you?
Oh, yeah, Eldred Quam was one. Dave Phillips taught me a lot. Very meticulous and figured things out. He didn't just fix something, he wanted to know why it broke, you know, and that's one thing you've got to think about all the time. Why is this breaking it? And you kind of start to figure it out, whether it's the airplane or it's the pilots or whatever. Some guys are hard on planes. They're good pilots, but they're hard on the equipment. Others are good at everything, and nothing goes wrong. They just keep going.
You worked in Barrow and Kotzebue and Fairbanks. And did were any of the remote locations you worked were special fondness for any of them? Did you really enjoy Kotzebue or?
I liked Barrow when I was up there, but that was back in the 60s, and it's all changed too because of the land claims and bullshit and everything. It's kind of disgusting. I was over at Kotzebue once, and I had a room in a hotel just above the entrance. And I'm laying there one night reading and thinking what the next step is. It's pretty late. And I hear some drunk down there hollering, "You goddamn white men." I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, where would you be without a white man? Mm-hmm. Kotzebue lives on the post office, welfare checks. The state has sent groups of people around who used to getting the natives to sign up to get the freeload. Put in all those sewer systems all around for all of them. And they can't hardly keep them running. They just got to have a bunch of white guys running around taking care of things. Mm. So, no, who knows?
Any memories about the Selenriches? Am I pronouncing that right?
Selenrich. Well, they were all Bud and Fred. There was a younger brother, but he got killed in a plane crash years ago. Years and years ago. Bud actually started working on planes with Harold Gillum down in Chitna. They were raised at Kennecott. Mother was a cook at the mine. That's where they learned to fly. And Bud was in the flying school and stuff. And, oh, there was a great big windstorm back in the mid-40s. And tore up everything, screwed up everything, and this and that. And finally, he sold his share of the Fairbanks. It was Fairbanks Air Service, I think. He sold it to Holly Evans and went from there. And he had Fairbanks Air Service for years. And Fred was in Fairbanks Aircraft in the maintenance end. He flew a lot, too. But he was one you never heard about because he didn't screw up. Mm-hmm. These guys that are so great, you start looking back, see how many wrecks they had and this and that. Oof. People remember Jules Thibodeau because he crashed so much. They don't remember Hal Bogenreif, who he had a few accidents, but that was about it. It was engine problems or ice or something. And something very, very rare. And you could turn him loose with an airplane out in the village, and he just trucked along. Sam White was another one. He flew for years for Weens.
And you mowed his lawn, didn't you?
No, I delivered his paper.
Oh,
God, he thought that was funny. His paper boy was fixing his airplane. That was a Hughes.
Did you, Selenriches were your uncles?
Yeah.
Uncles?
Yeah.
Did you get to know them very well when you were
young? Fred, yeah. Bud, not so much, because he was off Anchorage most of the time. He got sent back to Washington, D.C. He was with the FAA. And he hated that place. And then he got back to Alaska because of the big earthquake. Mm-hmm. He had to come back and take care of us. This and that, somehow we worked it. But yeah, Bud was very good. You could hear people curse FAA guys, different ones, you know, because they weren't knowledgeable and they just screwed you up. Not much help, more hindrance. But Bud was different. He'd work with a guy, tell him this and that.
In the Times, talking to Doug Millard, he'll tell a 2-hour story and it'll go this big circle and come back, and it always ends up criticizing the FAA.
Oh, yeah.
The FAA hasn't necessarily been a star in your mind either.
No. Some of their inspectors, this is basically what I dealt with, or Doug was dealing with flight people and all kinds of things. Some of the maintenance people were just great, and I would say 7/8, 3/4 were just following the book and putting in their time. And some of them would, personalities always enter into it. You get some FAA guy pissed at you and he'd be over inspecting, and criticizing all the time.
not much different than any other kind of bureaucrat, probably.
Yeah, and it's bad now. It's gone downhill. Most of the people they have over in the office here are ex-military, know nothing about small aircraft or the times and trials and tribulations you'd have working in this kind of climate. And, of course, you're dealing with a bunch of people that overloading all the time, the hunters, the guides, and that. Most of the air taxi guys have got to where they play are pretty straight for weights and everything else. Actually, you can make more money. You tell them, no, I can only take so much. It's going to be two trips. Well, so-and-so used to do it in one. Well, that was the other day. That's not today. They were there to kind of improve safety and keep things a little straight. And you need something like that. But they're not really doing their job, at least here.
Are most of the guys, the ex-military guys down there in the office, do they have any knowledge of Arctic conditions? And
I haven't dealt with them for 4 or 5 years. They seem to have ignored Part 91 airplanes. Just air taxi and pushing papers around the office. In my opinion, they've turned into the perfect bureaucracy. They've created enough paperwork that they just push it around from person to person and they don't really have to do much else. Mm-hmm. Everybody's happy.
Do you have a go-to guy down there that if you have to talk to someone, or did you used to?
Used to, yeah. Mark Smith, but they run him off, too. And I don't know anybody over there now. John Gamble was good. Harvey Holt was good. They'd come over and give you a heads up on things that were happening. But not anymore.
Can the leadership change at the top of the FAA, at the top of the bureaucracy, can it filter down and affect?
Very little.
Very little?
Okay. Yeah. They've all got districts, and the guy running the district is king of the heap. Fairbanks has been noted for years and years as a bum FAA station. They just... They don't approve things. They're just not too, not very good. That's known all over the country. That business a couple of years ago where one man decided that the shoulder harnesses were incorrect. They didn't have a tag on them. Well, earlier on we'd been told, well, yeah, the shoulder harness, you know, and if Christ put anything in, it's good. And added attraction because before that it was just lap belts. Well, and he got in there and decided they had to be approved, and the hooker harness, which is the best in the West, was no good. And that was really getting sticky until it was Sun and Fun or one of them, big meeting. The head FAA person was there. Mr. Hooker stood up himself and says, "What is going on with your people in Alaska? They're trying to put me out of business." And all of a sudden the shit hit the fan. This whole project got dropped. The guy got shifted somewhere else. He was so arrogant, he kept driving on the runway over here, which says no cars. And he would drive on the runway all the time. And I told him, "Don't you can't do that. No, keep your car off the runway." Well, he figured he could no matter what. So one guy caught him and says, "Next time you do this, I'm going to put you on citizen's arrest. Put you in handcuffs." He'd been warned, I don't know how many times. And he kept doing it. Maybe he was just trying to figure an angle to get out of here. I don't know. The story was he tried to get transferred to Idaho, and they said, "We don't want him either." Ended up, of course, in Oklahoma at the academy. I wonder what you got to do to get fired from the government. Probably kill your boss, I suppose.
Well, I've seen it at the university, which is part of being a government employee, where... What was the comment on the one guy? We had 14 years of stuff on him. 14 years of stuff on him? Why did you have 14 years of stuff on him? Why didn't you have 6 months of stuff and fire the guy? You know? I don't know.
Well, that one out there, Jerry Macbeth.
Gerald Macbeth,
Jesus, he's on the school board and he wanted to... Any kid was caught doing this or that, he'd be kicked out of school, and he gets drunk at about 8 o'clock in the morning. It's in a snowbank, denying everything, and oh, Jesus. And everybody says, what is going on here? But he stayed at the university.
Mm. What was amazing about that is that was a UAF policeman who came up on him on the ditch. And I'm surprised that someone like the president of the university didn't come down and say, just forget about that.
I think it was too late. It had gone too far already. I think he was in jail already or something.
He had a toothache, so he took a half a bottle of whiskey to treat his toothache and decided to go skiing.
Oh, yeah, something like that, yeah.
Ended up in the ditch.
How many of those professors out there got students running their classes?
Ah.
And they're collecting the money.
Mm-hmm. And they get upset when they have to go into the office once a month to have an hour of office hours.
Oh.
Or else they're on contract for 9 months and they're not here for 7 of the months.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, the university's full of silly stories. When Mom started there, the department head of the art department had ordered like a whole house full of tile, and he got it delivered to the art department, which the university paid for it, and then he had the students load it up in his truck so he could take it home and have it installed.
Oh, boy.
Stuff like that all the time.
Yeah.
I think the first question one of those professors asked my mom when she got a job up there in 1970, one of the interview questions was, how's your sex life?
Oh, Jesus. Ah. What's that got to do with anything?
Yeah, well...
And now there's so goddamn many queers out there, it's frightening.
Ah. Yeah, I suppose... Well, of course, you can't ask any of those questions at an interview anymore because you can't ask about health or sexual orientation or political views or work habits or do you show up to work on time or anything
like Jesus.
That.
Even that's verboten, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my.
We just got a... I had to do it online. It was the day before this last surgery. I had to go online and do 4 hours of bully training.
Oh.
Because you can't... you can only say something to somebody once, and if you say it a second time, you're bullying them. So if they're totally screwing up and you try to help them out, you can only bring it up one time because the second time you're bullying and...
Oh, God almighty. Well, you know, get political correct to the too much. Mm-hmm. This bullying all of a sudden is a big item to carry on with.
Yeah. The latest theme. I had a real hard time navigating when I went out to Michigan to go to graduate school. It was a real shift in political correctness from up here to out there. And I referred to some female friends of mine as... girls once. I said, how are you girls? We were out for a hike. I was like, how are you girls liking this hike or whatever? And you would have thought I called them all rabbit C words, you know. They were so mad at me, they wouldn't talk to me the rest of the time because I referred to them as girls. And that's not...
What were you supposed to call them?
Ladies, women. Calling them girls was sexualizing them.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Objects. And yeah, I had a real hard time out there. It was... I didn't fit very well.
Yeah, my oh my.
Well, Jim, I think I'm going to pack up my gear and make a run for it.
Okay.
My truck's been sitting out there. We've actually been talking for...
Okay, hour.
An hour, and I'm worried about my truck getting cold with that aluminum block.
Well, yes, that is a problem.